Houston Vision reporter Dave Atwood, featured guest Michael Yao, who recorded an interview with the Execution Watch from death row to be aired in the event of his execution. The Execution Watch for Michael Yao begins.
Good evening, this is Ray Hill. This is an execution night in the great state of Texas. Texas is scheduled to put Michael Yao to death in the death chamber. We have a reporter in Huntsville. Gloria, what's happening there?
What's that?
What's happening?
Well, there's a lot of people out here, Ray, but and what's happening is there's every kind of cop out here today. I think it's because we just left the Woodlands Pharmacy. But when we got here, there was all these, what we found out were cops on bicycles. We thought they were Domino's, people delivering pizza.
Oh,
but
okay.
We got four Houston, well, it looks like two of them may have left. Four Houston cops on bikes, all kinds of TDCJ cops. I don't know who that dude is in the blue shirt. There's just and when we got here, a state trooper was blocking the middle of the street. So apparently TDC is nervous now, well, that they have been outed.
Well, why don't you tell us what happened at that pharmacy in the Woodlands?
Well, we changed our tactics a little bit, and we went out there to thank them for offering to refund the money to TDC and take the drugs back. But nobody would talk to us. In fact, the security and the Montgomery County sheriffs were pretty hostile, kept threatening to arrest us for criminal trespassing. But we had a great group of people. We had a demonstration, got a lot of honks from passersby who read our signs. And It turned out very well, despite all the heavy security out there. Several of the media who were out there actually followed us to Huntsville, and
Gloria,
they're here in Huntsville.
Gloria, I want to put this in a little bit of context. What we discovered early last week was that a compounding pharmacy in the Woodlands. What's the name of that pharmacy?
It's called the Woodlands Compounding Pharmacy.
Okay, that makes it simple. The Woodlands Compounding Pharmacy had put together some drugs to be used in the execution chamber in Texas. Now, we found out that compounding pharmacies are not licensed under the regular Food and Drug Act qualifications,
right.
So there is a little something shady about their doing that, and that Texas Department of Criminal Justice had paid them some large amount of money to make these drugs, and there was an agreement between the pharmacy and the state of Texas that all of this would be on the QT and nobody would know who they were or what they had done.
On the down low.
On the down low was exactly the words they used. And then all of a sudden, we were able to get that information. Who actually got that information, Gloria? Do you know?
There's been so much information disclosed. Some of it was gotten because the attorneys for Michael Yao and Michael Perry, I think, and Thomas Whitaker were in court challenging the use of these drugs.
Uh-huh.
And I talked to one of the attorneys today, and what isn't known is if TDC had already gotten their letter when they were in court Friday or Thursday, whenever it was.
The letter demanding the drugs back and offering to pay the state back.
Right. But they didn't mention that to the judge. And that came out in the news, I guess, the next day.
Okay, but at any rate, activists all over the world found out about it, and all of a sudden there was a flood of information into the Woodlands to that pharmacy about, wait a minute, why are you contributing to the death of Texans?
Right, right. In fact, they've actually closed their website, and I know every time I called, the women who answered the phone said, well, I can't comment on that. The owners are the only ones that can comment, and they're not in. So, thank you.
Okay, now,
and as they put it, they found themselves surrounded by a firestorm of controversy, letters, phone calls, and emails, and hate mail.
Okay.
That's encouraging that people all over the place don't appreciate anybody selling execution drugs to TDCJ.
Have the witnesses cross the street?
The Woodlands what?
The witnesses cross the street.
Oh, no, nothing's happening. And Elizabeth told me that the Supreme Court hadn't ruled yet, and it is 5 after. Nobody has crossed the street.
Okay, will you do me this favor and get in touch with Elizabeth?
Uh-huh.
If anything happens, because it's fundraising time and the incoming telephones to KPFT are not readily available.
Okay, I want to make just 2 points. Number one, Michael Yao obviously has serious mental issues. Most of us don't kill our family and blow up the house. So it's illegal to execute somebody that's mentally ill. So he shouldn't even be here tonight. And the second thing is that TDCJ is a damn liar because they are buying these drugs under a DEA number for a Huntsville unit hospital that has been shut down for 30 years. Now, if I got that number and tried to get drugs, I would probably be arrested.
Okay, Gloria. Michael Yao is going to deal with explaining it himself. He is the interview in today's story.
Fantastic.
And thank you for pointing out that the Walls Hospital, which I was in when I was an inmate in the early 60s, has been closed for decades.
Yeah, but apparently they can still buy drugs.
Okay, thank you, Glory. We'll talk to you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And now we go to Jim. What the hell happened in this case?
Pretty straightforward and pretty simple. Michael Gale was 28 years old when this happened. Lived in Lubbock and had a bad drug and probably mental problems. He slipped into his father's mother's house late one night to steal money from his father. His father woke up. He shoots and kills his father. This wakes up his mother, and his mother wakes up. He begins to stab her. That doesn't work, so he strangles her to death with electric cord. After he killed both of them, he ran to the house and opened up a gas jet and left, because up in that part of the country, they use a lot of natural gas. And what happened, his grandmother, who was disabled, was living at the house. When she came out of the bedroom, apparently from the contact with the metal hinges, it set off a spark, and the house blew up. And, of course, it burned both bodies beyond recognition, seriously injured the grandmother. She later died. And what happened, Yao was convicted, he was captured about 2 days later. He admitted all of this. He admitted going to the house, trying to steal the money, and gave some pretty graphic details in his confession of how long it took to kill his mother. And they found him guilty, and then there was a question about guilt.
Hold on, let's get, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, you're on.
It's noisy here.
You're on.
Okay.
Where is here?
We are at the corner of Almeda and Holcomb, right outside by where the Dominican Sisters have their home over here.
Okay. And what kind of crowd you got out there?
Not too many today, Ray. We got 6 people right now.
Okay, you remember what happened the last time we did one of these shows and the Supreme Court had not made final judgment?
Right.
And nobody had crossed the road and the process has not begun?
Right.
We are there again tonight, and hopefully is a good sign. Maybe something will happen and this execution will not happen, but it is not stayed. It is simply delayed.
Okay, all right.
And so we're doing the best that we can. Dave, while I've got you on the air, your organization, the Texas
Coalition
to Abolish the Death Penalty, is going to have an event here at KPFT tomorrow?
Right, tomorrow night. It's tomorrow night, Ray, and you're on.
Okay, tomorrow night is a Thursday,
right.
And the 10th, and there's going to be a shindig out in the backyard here at KPFT, and from all weather reports that I've seen, it's going to be an ideal night to be in the backyard.
I think it'll be great, and as you know, we'll be celebrating World Day Against the Death Penalty. And that's sponsored by an organization called the World coalition against the death penalty that's based in Paris, France, or right around Paris. And we like to you know, bring this out every year so people know that there are people all over the world that are opposing the death penalty. In fact, there's 140 countries that have done away with the death penalty. So that's what we'll be doing tomorrow night. We'll be celebrating World Day Against the Death Penalty.
All right. Dave, give our regards to the other vigilants there.
I will. There are some sturdy anti-death penalty people here all the time.
Since you may have a sister or two out there, have them offer up prayers that this does not happen tonight.
Okay, will do.
Thank you, Dave.
All righty. You take care. Bye-bye.
And that was Dave Atwood out at the convent at Alameda and OST. And Susan, you have a piece of this puzzle you're covering?
Yes. Okay. In the shall we say, punishment phase of the trial, well, the state called a parole officer, and the parole officer testified that Jarl was released from prison to a halfway house. She also testified that he had a history of years of being in and out of drug programs and mental health programs. There was also, she also testified that 2 months prior to the crime that he was on trial for, he was in violation of parole because of, he was accused of the offenses of stealing checks, forgery, and unlawful credit card use. That apparently was his mother's checks, his mother's credit card. And that he used his mother's credit card to purchase some prohibited firearms and, of course, used some false information when he was making the purchase. The defense put on some evidence of his history of mental health disorder and his long history of drug use. They put that evidence on at the guilt or innocence phase of the trial. It could have been repeated again at the punishment phase of the trial. However, it was put on at guilt or innocence. The defense hired a psychologist named Dr. Philip Davis to testify, to review his medical records, his mental health medical records, and to testify at the trial. So when Dr. Davis testified, he testified at guilt or innocence. He was allowed to, in effect, read the medical records, his medical mental health records in. However, his testimony was limited to really him, you could say, reading the records. He was not allowed to give an opinion, an expert opinion, on Mr. Yowell's state of mind.
I thought expert witnesses were allowed to have opinions.
Well, but in this particular case, the defense team did not have the psychologist examine Jarl. And so because he never examined him, and the defense team did not notify the state that he would testify as an expert, because of that, the judge limited his testimony and did not allow him to state an opinion. Okay, so that's basically what happened.
Jim wants a piece of this because my question's...
Let me kind of clarify what we're talking about. What happened at trial, he claimed insanity.
Okay.
And so here's the problem. When you claim insanity, you're supposed to give the notice to the state ahead of time that you're going to claim insanity and give them the information for a psychiatrist. Most defense lawyers are petrified because that means that when the state psychiatrist come in and examine him too. So when you ask for a psychiatric exam, that opens a door for a state psychiatrist to come in, and then they'll say horrible things about your client. So what these lawyers tried to do to avoid that, they didn't give the notice. And that's where the problem came in, that they're going to use an expert to testify about insanity. And that's how that came in at guilt. It limited on guilt or innocence because of lack of notice and because the state were not able to call their own psychiatrist to rebut the insanity defense. So insanity with defense was knocked out at trial. And what happened, the lawyers on writs, they were criticizing the lawyers for not reintroducing that insanity information at the punishment hearing. That was one of the bases of the writ. And that's why... what we're talking about, because it's real dangerous when you claim insanity. That means you have to let your client be examined by a state psychiatrist, and that's never good.
Okay. Because of the, Susan, because of the incident of Dr. Death and other fond people that the state uses as throwdown witnesses and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the defense team did not want the state's expert to examine Mr. Yarrell, so they did not have their expert examine him. And then apparently Mr. Yarrell, after he was held guilty of the crime, did not want to put on a case, instructed his lawyers not to put on a case at punishment. However, his lawyer proceeded, and the lawyer played the video, I mean, not the video, but the audio of his confession. And the confession is apparently about 45 minutes long, and as it nears towards the end, he expresses some, you could say, remorse for the crime, and the defense lawyer essentially played that and argued that it was an expression of remorse.
The audience is going to hear an interview from the defendant as he awaits decision from the Supreme Court. My name is Ray Hill. This is Execution Watch. We're in KPFT Houston studios on the HD3 channel tonight and on the Internet. We hope you have found us. If you want other people to listen to this, we'll be on the archive of executionwatch.org, or they can go directly to www.kpft.org tomorrow and go to the HD3 channel archive, and you'll be able to hear the show. It will be kept there for a couple of months. Jack, do you have a piece that we need to hear from before we play the interview?
Mike, you want to pull the microphone?
One of the interesting issues that came up was an insanity plea. And when I say an insanity plea, as Susan testified, the court-appointed lawyers brought up the insanity issue in the appellate court. One of the issues they talked about was whether or not it was properly presented by the lawyer. The appellate courts first reversed it back for further discussion, and then it decided that since it was mentioned in the trial, it was no mention to mention in punishment. But that really gets away from the main issue here, because the main issue here is you got three things that could have been talked about. Number one, this person who did this act could have pled a defense of intoxication, drug abuse. That doesn't work.
It doesn't work at all.
It's not a defense. You can't use that. The next thing you can come up with is an insanity plea.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with an insanity plea is to plead insanity. Insanity is a defense.
Yeah.
Insanity is a defense that goes back to 1600s England mm-hmm. in the McGarton case, where it's a defense where you admit you did it, but you didn't know the difference in right or wrong.
Could have been used in defense of George III.
It's a very, very tough thing to say, because you're admitting you committed the crime, but only because you did not understand the right from wrong is that a defense. He does not have that defense, and the reason he doesn't have the defense is there's too many things he did during the crime that shows he knew what he was doing. Number one, just before he committed the crime, he went out and bought guns. And he bought guns under different names because he knew that he was the next convict and would be caught. Shows he knows what he was doing. Number two, when the crime happened, he tried to cover up the crime by putting the gas on and blowing up the evidence of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
This shows he knew it was wrong, he knew it wasn't right, and the classic case of insanity we've had in Harris County is the Andrea Yates case. Andrea Yates drowned her five children, then called the police. That is somebody who's not understanding the consequences of what they did.
Yeah.
He tried to destroy evidence.
And hide.
So insanity is not going to work. The last thing he could have brought up is competency. Competency is not a defense. Some people think it is. Competency just says you're not in a mental frame of mind to go to court right now. You can't help your lawyer. You can't defend yourself. You can't communicate. If you're found incompetent, it's not a defense. The case is not dismissed. You're just put away someplace until you are competent, and then you're brought back to court. So realistically, the competency is not going to help him. The insanity was nothing that he could plead. And drug and alcohol abuse is not a reason as an excuse to this.
Mike, in the trial transcript, and I take it that y'all understood that, according to his interview, it was kind of raucous in that courtroom. Was that evident from the file?
It was not evidence from the file that I read.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to play the interview with Michael Yao. This interview was taken in the visit room at the Polunsky unit just a few weeks ago. This is Michael Yowell, who is scheduled to be executed by Texas Department of Criminal Justice tonight.
Michael Yowell, you're from Lubbock.
Yes.
And you know you're now scheduled to be executed next year?
October 9th.
October 9th.
Yes.
That's just 4 days before my birthday. I'd sure like for you to stick around, at least for the celebration of my birthday.
I'd like to stick around for celebration of my birthday.
I'm not going to ask you any questions about guilt or innocence or that kind of stuff, but I want to know what this whole journey has been like for you. And so let's start with, tell me about that trial. That trial happened in Lubbock? Or?
Yes, in okay. Lubbock. Yes, I asked for a change of venue, but they would not grant it.
Okay.
In my hometown, it was a high-profile case for my hometown, probably the highest-profile case out of my hometown. Wasn't much of a trial. DA presented all the evidence. My lawyers attempted to put one witness on the stand and never notified the court of his intent of what the expert witness was going to render an opinion on me. He entered 800-plus pages of back mental health records and history like that were never objected to. The psychologist on the stand read verbatim from some of the little highlights from the notes or from the medical notes.
And all that got into the record.
That was into the record. When my lawyer went to ask him questions about my mental health, the judge pretty much stopped him because the guy had never examined me. He asked my attorney what his intent was, and he would never really tell him. And pretty much the only witness at my trial just got kicked out of the stand.
Did the state put in evidence to the contrary of what your expert witness had to say?
No, they didn't have to because he wasn't even allowed to testify. My lawyers never asked any hypothetical questions to try to get any answers. They never tried to save their witness. Come the guilt-innocence part of the trial, they did nothing. Absolutely nothing. In fact, what they did do was play my taped confession, which had already been played by the DA, again, against my wishes.
Mm-hmm.
Not only did they do that, when I objected to them playing this, the judge brought us up to the bench, told us we needed to go talk about it. We went to a room, had a real heated argument. I was very upset because by this time I had found out that my investigator never went and talked to my girlfriend, which was a suspect in the crime, never talked to the person that gave me the gun, which was also a suspect in the crime, never talked to my ex-wife or pretty much anybody that I asked him to. And this person had told me he knew my family, worked for my family, and had known him when he was going to college and worked in their bars and stuff as a bar back. And I thought, you know, he quoted a cousin's husband of mine that owned all the bars. And I'm like, okay, all right. He said, this pretty much straight applied to me. I did not find out that they had not talked to any of these people other than my ex-wife, which she was released from the witness list by both sides, and she was in the courtroom, and she had asked me, well, why didn't your lawyers come talk to me? Previous to this, she said lawyers had talked to them, and I thought she meant my lawyers, but she pointed to the DA and said, no, they come and talk to me and question your lawyers. I've never met. So I'm processing all. I'm finding out this during the middle of my trial when I should have known about it months ahead of time. From that point on, we're in this room, we're having a heated argument. My lawyer leaves, comes back, and says the judge wants to see us. The judge kind of admonished me. He says, you know, I don't want any more interruptions out of you, blah, blah, blah. I want you to go there, sit down. And I said, well, that's why I'm bringing this up now. And he said, you know, you need to listen to your lawyers. And I said, you know, it's my life. I'm the one that made the choices that got me here. And he said, that's true. And I said, I don't want them doing it. You know, I it's not that I don't want them to argue my case.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't want them to do it in this context, this way. previous to this, I did not know or was not aware that my lawyer had went and told the judge that I told him to do absolutely nothing to save my life, which was untrue. That's not what I instructed him. Even when I'm talking to the judge, it was never addressed. And
but
my lawyer had just took my...
the medium?
It didn't come out until my appeals.
Okay.
And that was one of the main reasons why in my appeals that I've lost my appeals is because they're saying I instructed my lawyers not to do anything, which wasn't true.
Prior to this case, did you have a long history of having some mental complications?
Yes, I'd been diagnosed with bipolar as early as 1991. I'd gone to rehab in there, and after staying up like 20, sleeping maybe an hour or two a day for 28 days, and they know I'm not on any drugs because they're taking blood and urinalysis. That's when, you know, they diagnosed me. I did not find out a lot of things until after, you know, during my appeals that my...
How old were you when all this happened?
I was 28.
28. And so you have now spent how many years on the road?
I've been locked up 15 years, 13 plus years here on the road.
13 plus years.
November will be 14 years.
Okay. So those, when you're 28, you're not a kid, but those are very important formative years.
Yes, well, my history goes way back. I got involved in drugs as early, you know, 9, 10 years old. By the time I was 13, I was injecting methamphetamine. My parents didn't do drugs, but my dad was a gambler. He was a bookie. I grew up in a criminal element, that type of lifestyle.
Were you basically dosing some of the psychological demons you were dancing with?
Well, I'd had a pretty rough upbringing as far as things. I had a real violent older brother, real violent history there. Had been molested. A lot of my childhood was blocked out for years. In my early 20s, it started coming back. And by then, I was definitely using drugs to try. I didn't want to go to sleep because I'd go to sleep and I'd have nightmares. And it was all about my past. Most people would have never thought I would have ever done this. Steal something to get drugs. No problem. Break into something, no problem. They understood I was capable of doing that. I had not been a violent person.
So the prosecutors blocked significant parts of the evidence in your trial.
Well, it wasn't the prosecutors. It was my own attorneys.
But your own attorneys did not present.
My own attorneys would not. Not did not. They had a plethora of evidence. I'm talking about that 800 plus pages had my whole history. As far
they
as
were
my drug,
appointed, Mario?
Yes, appointed. And Jack Stoffregan now is the head guy over the 85 county, the capital punishment deal in West Texas. He's the head guy. If he's found ineffective, one, they'd have to give me a retrial. Two, any case that he's represented would be up for questioning. Three, they would have to appoint me somebody that's not even affiliated with that office for a new trial, whether it's just a punishment phase.
Okay, so you got through the trial. How long was the jury out?
Not very long. It wasn't very long as far as guilt.
It wasn't multiple days?
No, it was that day.
Punishment in your problem?
Not very long. I mean, they come back. I mean, there was nothing presented on my behalf for them to even, other than the medical records, in which they didn't even understand why it was presented. You know, my lawyers never gave a reason why they put that on when they did. Excuse me. If anything, it should have been presented as mitigating evidence at the punishment phase. But even in that, they never gave any validity or depth. They never explained what bipolar was, how it affects your mind. They didn't explain drug addiction. They didn't explain things like sleep deprivation. When you stay up, you know, normal people, when they stay up more than 3 or 4 days, they start going through different psychosis just because your brain needs time to rest. I mean, that's what REM sleep is for.
Sure.
Whereas now I have bipolar. I'm staying up 10 to 15 days at a time. If you ever see pictures of me, I weighed 105 pounds. I look like a Holocaust victim. You know, I was in bad shape. Not only that, prior to this, a doctor had told me I wasn't going to live due to a hepatitis hepatitis C infection in my liver. That and the drugs. At the time, I'd been clean for about, I don't know, 70, 80 days. So I had a lot going on. I'm responsible for everything. I made the choices that I made, and that's me.
Well, you're also entitled to adequate representation.
And that is true. You know, no matter what I did, I understand. You know, I've never said that I never needed to be locked up. At that time in my life, I definitely needed to be off the streets for my own safety, whether it was any, or anybody else's, for my own, because I was I was completely out of control.
What says the appeal? How was your appeal handled?
Pretty much the way my case was handled. Every appeal attorney I've had has withdrew from my case. Direct appeal attorney withdrew from my case, and I got appointed another one. My state habeas appeal attorney filed my appeal and then withdrew from my case. The guy that replaced him did the oral arguments on my state habeas hearing and withdrew from my case. I never even told me. The guy that was co-counsel on him was the one that picked up my case on a federal level. But I did not know. No one had sent me anything. I didn't even know I was denied in the courts until 8 months later after I'd been denied, when the guy that's representing me now, or one of the guys that's representing me now, notifies me that he's, you know, filing for, you know, indigent. You know, he wants to become my attorney. At that time, I was like, well, okay, he's familiar with my case. He is from my hometown. Bad thing is, he's a felon recovering addict. This guy has nearly lost his license because he was getting high in his car with the secretary, snorting cocaine and coming back to court high. And you know, he's also been found ineffective on someone else's case due to the investigator had gotten with the victim's family and ended up. The victim's widow in that case left him her whole estate. So it's been a kind of a crazy deal, but it all, my whole appeal is based on what my lawyers did not do at my trial. I've had a reversal for a punishment phase. It was taken away based on that I didn't meet one prong of Strickland, and also they're trying to say that I told my attorneys not to do anything to save my life, which was never on record. It was never addressed in the courts, even after my attorney said this outside of my presence. I never even knew he told the judge this. But even in after he told the judge this, when I spoke to the judge, I'm telling him I want him to do something different. I just don't want him to play this confession. It's not going to help me. All it's going to do is have this jury hear me say I committed this crime. Again, that's all it's going to do. His closing arguments was an 11-line statement. So basically just a few sentences. You know, 11 top lines on the transcripts.
Well, you know that once you get a date, then that's another round starts.
Okay, now we get to him. You probably already heard. You've heard Ross Vaughn talk about his attorney. There's another guy here on death watch right now that's fixed, you know, the next guy that has a date. He has the same attorney as me. We all three have had the same attorney doing our federal appeals. This guy has told me, as well as the other two individuals, that he can't do anything for us because we're guilty of multiple homicides. He's told me that in letters. I have it documented on letters. I asked him to file en banc court in the Fifth Circuit before I got a date. He refused to do so. He said he wasn't going to, his credit, he, there was government sanctions against him to prevent him from doing that. He wasn't going to ruin his credibility. Then he tried to tell me that my claim that I wanted him to claim was a spurious and frivolous claim, and that he wouldn't do it. Even if he couldn't do it in the manner that I asked him to, which was filing into a lower court, I wanted to do it as a lawsuit. He could still file it to a lower court because it's never been raised. The issue that I asked him to raise had never been raised. It's been bounced around in different manners, and then it goes on to this. He puts that same issue that he told me was frivolous and spurious that the reason he wouldn't do it is because I'm guilty of murder. He puts in my writ of certiorari. Not only does he put it on the writ of certiorari, in the stay of execution, he has Carl Blue's name in there. He has Roberto Garza's conviction date in my writ of certiorari. He has the filing date of Ross.
He's processing through a word processor.
He has Ross Vaughn's filing date on the stay of execution. I didn't even have a date, May 3rd. So there's no reason for him to file a stay of execution. I didn't get an execution date until June 4th.
Is this your first date?
This is my first date. Then the claim that I wanted him to put into a lower court, he files on my writ of certiorari into the Supreme Court. If you read the state's response on that, the Attorney General's response, it shows I'm procedurally barred because this issue has never been raised before. My whole experience with the courts or with the attorneys is one that, you know, they're paid by the state. To me, they're working for the state for this reason, because everything that I've asked them to do, none of them have ever done anything. But yet, the things that I've asked them to do are the things now that is why I'm not getting the reverse or getting any action. So my attorneys have completely, utterly failed me, you know.
So you don't sound real optimistic that you're going to get a break on this, even though it's your
first
day.
And you know, and you have to go back and look at what my case is about. My case involved my own family members, three of my family members. You know, if the execution goes through, the only thing it's going to do is create another victim for my family members. You know, even the ones that did not and hate what I did. You know, one time in my life, I was one of their loved ones. And all they're going to do is lose another family member. The worst thing that the state could ever do to me is let me live. And the reason why is to live with the guilt and the remorse and the shame of what I've done. I've never denied what I've done. I've never tried to hide behind it. I committed a horrible, tragic crime. I don't make excuses for it. It's something horrible, tragic. I can't change it, but killing me is not also going to, is never going to bring any of them people back.
But isn't the issue is whether or not you're mentally capable, culpable, mentally culpable?
Yes. I mean, at that time in my life, if you go back in my history, yes, it shows that I wasn't. But proving that and getting people to accept that is a total different deal. Because one, they're, you know, in the stage sexes, voluntary, you know, if you're intoxicated, whether it's drugs, alcohol, whatever, that's not a defense.
Well, you understand the position of Execution Watch and me is that the solution to killing is not more killing.
Yes.
To killing is less killing.
And my deal is, one, you cannot find an individual on death row that will ever tell you that had I known I was going to death row, I wouldn't have committed this crime. Because no one, when they're committing these crimes, them thoughts are not going through your mind. What's going through your mind is whatever set of circumstances you were going through at that time.
By the same time, the message they're trying to send by executing never gets to the people that
Exactly. Not only that, one, it's not a deterrent to crime. Because you have a whole penitentiary full of people that's got capital life sentences or murderers out there. There's not, you know, a lot of my arguments against the death penalty is this. You can have two people with the same set of circumstances or similar circumstances. Two guys go into a convenience store, robs the convenience store, maybe the store clerk pulls a gun on, whatever the reason. They shoot and kill the person. They leave. They're arrested later on. This county may not be over here, may not be able to afford a trial. This county may be over here, can't afford it. Or, these dudes, this guy is up for election, and he wants to show he's tough on crime. In my hometown, the guy that prosecuted my case, just like Ross Vaughn,
in Lubbock, nobody ever run for election being weak on crime.
But, you know, I don't think it's right that they should use cases like this as a political deal. I don't think it's right that you know, there's no fairness in you know, as far as, you know, I understand we need punishment. I've never been against that. I understand why prisons are here. But when you can't have an equal type of punishment for the same type of crime, then no, we don't need to have this type of system.
Michael, I want to thank you for the interview. I have your permission to broadcast this on radio.
Yes, actually, I wish it would be broadcast earlier because my whole issue is getting awareness out there that, hey, man, my lawyers didn't do anything for me, period.
Well, maybe the word will get out. Thank you.
All right.
Well, the word did not get out before Michael is being executed. Gloria is waiting for a report from Huntsville. Gloria, you're on the air.
I'll be able to hear you. Oh, you know what? No, they won't.
Gloria.
Yes, right.
You're on the air.
Well, the execution is happening. Michael's wife and daughters and, oh, I'm so sorry, and friends and spiritual advisor just crossed the street right now. So the execution is getting ready to happen. And I know that the guys on death row can't hear us tonight because of thumb drive, but another day, another execution. Although, interesting, how many cops are here? And one of the people standing next to me is one of Michael's good friends who had last visits with him, and talked to him on the phone just a little while ago if you want to talk to her.
Please.
Ray?
Yes, please.
Hello?
Please, Gloria.
Okay. All right. Hang on just a second. This is Ray Hill with Execution One on the radio. Okay. Hello.
You're on the radio. Who are you?
My name is Melissa Partridge. I've known Michael for a couple years now.
And you've been corresponding with him?
Yeah, I've been corresponding with them for a couple years. I go and visit whenever I can, and I actually went and saw him for the last time Tuesday, you know, yesterday, and I was the last person he was able to talk to on the phone today, so.
And the witnesses have crossed the road, the execution
Yeah, they just crossed the road.
We just heard an interview with Michael on the show, and thank you for your friendship to Michael, and thank you for sharing with us.
Without a doubt, man. I love Michael to pieces. I just wish there was something more that I could do to help him.
We fully understand the frustration.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Bye-bye.
Okay, and we're back to the studio. And let me see. You can disconnect all that. Larry, what piece of this story have you got?
Well, Ray, I just want to talk about a related issue, and that is the Harris County Felony Mental Health Court. Mental health issues, Ray, as you know, are difficult to deal with, even in the absence of criminal cases.
Mm-hmm.
But when you add a felony to a person with a mental health issue, it becomes almost a nightmare. The fact is that the issue, the legal issues of either sanity or competency, when they are even removed, There are many mental health issues that don't rise to the level of either sanity or competency that greatly affect what ought to be done in a case where a person is accused of a felony and has mental health issues. So the Harris County Mental Health Court has been in existence for the last year and a half or so.
That would not really have affected this case.
Would not have affected it at all, Ray. Not at all. But this court is just, we're just talking about how the mental health issues in felony cases in general, something more needs to be done.
If this matter had been referred to a felony court in some of his prior convictions, might that have had an effect on
The hope is that it would have, because there are so many things that could have been done in terms of treatment. So the whole idea about the mental health court is to give them a carefully tailored continuum of treatment programs that are specifically tailored to the individual. So if a person has a mental health issue and is charged with a felony, then it is conceivable that they can go to the mental health court. Now, the mental health court has a lot of a wide range of things that they can do, anything from pretrial diversion to deferred adjudication to just straight probation, what's called community supervision. In order for a person with a mental health issue to get into the court, and Harris County has 22 different felony courts that have their own dockets, but this is a separate docket by just one court.
Sure.
This
is I was court. Around when Jan Crocker and others got together to create this entity, and what struck me was two things, and I appreciate your incorporating this. Number one, it doesn't apply to any misdemeanor. I don't care what the misdemeanor is or how crazy the person is. In the second place, there are serious assaults and attempted murders and murders and robberies to which it also does not apply.
Right. If they're assaultive offenses, not murders, but certain assaultive offenses, they look at them a little bit more closely, chances are they probably would not get in. This is primarily, I believe, for thefts and really people who have underlying mental health issues that are oftentimes associated with drug-related issues.
Yeah.
And so what the person has to do is, when in consultation with his lawyer, they apply to the mental health court. So the lawyers, and it's a voluntary kind of thing, but you have to apply and you might not necessarily get in. Mm-hmm. Once you're screened, because you've got to have an active felony court, felony case pending, and you have to have a documented diagnosis of mental health issues. So they review all of those things and they determine then whether they will let you in. And in the screening process, they make it very clear that, you know, if you don't want to be here, we don't want you here, because it's funded by a grant. The availability is limited, so they want it for those people who are eligible and are motivated. And so there's a wide range of things that they can do, everything from lockdown drug treatment programs. The program lasts for at least 18 months. Could last for even longer.
Sure.
So they try to get them the mental health assistance that they need in order not to reoffend. The whole thing is to reduce the rate of recidivism.
Do you perceive that this is actually making a difference in the treatment of mental health issues as it relates to criminal laws in Harris County?
I believe it does. It gives the person who's accused of a felony at least the opportunity. Now, I haven't looked at what their rates are of success. But there are so many cases where you look at it and say, this is not really a criminal case. I mean, the person might have the requisite culpability when you look at sanity and competency, but they're impaired. And so we need to do something different with them. And I think the mental health court is that kind of, it's like the veterans court or the drug court to seek some sort of alternative resolution to a criminal issue. And particularly, I'm more excited about the pretrial diversion, because those who are entitled to a pretrial diversion never enter a plea of guilty and can at some point have the record expunged.
Larry, the availability of institutional space for mental illness outside of Harris County Jail being the largest mental institution in the state, there's not a lot of options other than incarceration available. I mean, we've got state schools elsewhere, and there's MHMR, which is a semi-secure facility. But my question is, if these people have some serious mental incapacities that outpatient treatment alone is not going to fix, then what do you do with them?
And Ray, that's really what the problem is. We don't know, but they're trying to figure out, is there something? And it's such a case by case kind of a continuum of possible treatments that there are some for whom it helps. And if it doesn't help permanently, at least it helped for 18 months.
Shouldn't all of criminal justice be careful case-by-case evaluation? Shouldn't we be looking at everything as what is with this individual? How do we make this individual safe? How do we make this individual productive? How do we keep this individual out of institutions where they deteriorate and put them where they can prosper and grow?
Right. The I guess it's just a matter of what the purpose of the program is. Now, this is primarily geared toward treatment, and you know that the criminal justice system is geared toward punishment. It is an accusation that you have committed an offense against the peace and dignity of the state of Texas.
Yep.
And then the state of Texas has its own set of standards as to what's going to happen to you in terms of range of punishment that you can be imposed upon you for what you are accused of having done, and the jury might find you guilty.
Well, the longer I interviewed Michael, the less sane he appeared. At first, he seemed to have a good grip of things, and the longer we went on together, he kind of, in my mind, deteriorated so that, in the end, he said, I'm helpless, I deserve what I'm getting, I just don't think that's a solution to the problem. And there was a certain amount of sanity in that, wasn't there?
There is, Ray, and the problem is, you're talking about the solution to the problem. Unfortunately, when you don't have a solution, unfortunately, the society that we live in right now says we can eliminate the problem one way or the other.
Well, let's slip Jack in here because Jack has been working on something. What is it, Jack?
Well, part of the issue that I was exploring was the question of insanity and how this how the insanity defense works and how we got where we are. The current insanity defense is based upon the McNaughton rule, as Mike talked about earlier. The McNaughton rule is basically, did you know what you were doing, and did you know it was wrong? It's a two-pronged test. Did you actually know, if I'm driving a car, do I know I'm driving a car? When I plow through into a building, did I know that plowing through a building is wrong? And that's the two-pronged test. And this test came about largely because of John Hinckley Jr. when he tried to assassinate, Ronald Reagan in, I think it was 81, to try to impress Jodie Foster. And what ended up happening was that when the law changed in 84, the burden of proof shifted from the prosecution to prove that you were sane to the defense to show through preponderance of evidence that you were
okay,
insane.
It's a different standard than the normal criminal.
It's a different standard.
And it's on the wrong people. I mean, burden of proof rests
the
with
burden
the state,
of proof,
except in this instance.
Right, except in this instance. Effectively, the insanity defense is an affirmative defense. You know, hey, I didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't know what I was doing was wrong.
You practice juvenile law.
I do some, not much.
What about kids that are identifiably mentally damaged going through that system? Is there a checkpoint in that system where they can be paid attention to?
The citizens of Harris County aren't really willing to fund that. So the answer is no.
Do you suspect that's a problem that is widespread in Texas or in the country?
You don't want to get me started on what's wrong.
No. I think that every time we come in this room,
sure,
we are dealing with what's wrong. I think Jim has been dealing with what's wrong probably longer than the rest of us. And we come here, and it is our job to rub the cat hair the wrong direction.
I think so much of what we're doing is we're living in a bubble wrap world for kids. And if kids were allowed to get into trouble and kids were allowed to explore and cut themselves get into fights and things like that, I think a lot of the problems that we have with kids wouldn't be there.
In other words, we should go back to 1952 modern. In high
I don't
school.
Know if we should.
Because I got into fights in school.
Sure.
Because people would make fun of my boyfriends and I would whoop their butt.
And didn't that make you a better man?
Absolutely. It certainly made me more respected in the halls of Woodland Acres Junior High School in Galena Park.
Sure. But at the same time, you knew what was required to be
Absolutely.
A man.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Of course, I started a lot of fights just as Mr. Barté, the assistant principal, was walking out of the building so he could see it and stop it quickly. You've been listening to a show about the execution of Michael Yowell. We may laugh and chuckle in here, and we may talk about each other, but this is a very serious matter to us. And, of course, it's an even more serious matter to the people who know and cared about Michael Yowell. This program is broadcast tonight on HD3 channel. You can find it on the archive of kpft.org. You will find it very soon on executionwatch.org. And then the tape, videotape of my interview with Michael Yao, along as the videotape, thank you, Otis, of this show will be combined together, and it will be broadcast on hmstv.org. If you live in Houston, you can see it on Channel 17, Comcast. We do this show because we have to. We do this show to raise your consciousness. I was explaining to a KPFT loyal person, pacifist in the house, that executions are not about what the person that is being executed has done and who they are. Executions are about us and what we do. I want to thank Elizabeth Stein for the fine work of preparing this program. I want to thank KPFT for allowing us to broadcast. I want to thank Jim Skelton. I want to thank Susan Ashley. I want to thank Larry Douglas. I want to thank Jack Lee. I want to thank Mike Gillespie for the fine work that they did contributing to this. Doyle is our engineer tonight. I want to thank Doyle for doing a very careful job in an awkward circumstances to make it all work. Gloria Grubach in Huntsville and Dave Atwood here in Houston and all of the vigilance therein. The struggle continues. My name is Ray Hill. This is KPFT. Thank you very much for listening to Execution Watch. Thank you, Victoria Panetti, for the wonderful music we use at the beginning and the end of the show.